Now, please welcome PJ O'Rourke and moderator Melissa Kane.
My workout for the day. Well, as some of you may know, I was a columnist before I became an analyst over at CBS, and so for many years I relied on PJ's works. I shamelessly stole his ideas and tried to copy him for so many years, so I'm just so excited to be here tonight. I'll try to be cool. Okay. So, as you know, when we get started for the purposes of the podcast and such, we do the gavel bang at the beginning and at the end, and you know, it's like one of my favorite things. So, very excited. So, I'm going to hit the gavel three times, and then I'm going to start with a good evening. We'll introduce Mr. O'Rourke, and then he will come up and make some remarks, and then we will begin the Q&A session. Okay? All right. All right, here we go. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Melissa Kane, political and legal analyst for CBS News San Francisco and your moderator for today's program. Our guest tonight is hilarious no matter what subject he tackles, and we're so excited to have him join us. I could tell you that PJ O'Rourke is a best-selling author and incomparable political satirist whose work has spanned more than three decades. I could also tell you that he's the most quoted living man in the Penguin Dictionary of Modern Humorous Quotations. But to really examine his greatness, I turned to the internet. And not just any internet, I examined the reviews on Amazon for his most recent book, an anthology of his work called Thrown Under the Cromnibus. In those Amazon reviews, there was one that was quite negative, and I will read it to you now. Okay. Unfortunately, not included in this book are the more recent pieces he has written for Atlantic Monthly, The Weekly Standard, The Daily Beast, et al., including a recent article/review about noisy conservative Ann Coulter, who he describes as a butt trumpet. So we know two things. First, you might want to add the butt trumpet thing to your next book. And second, even in the vapid hellscape that is the internet comment section, the worst that could be said is that his readers want more. And that is just one more reason why we are so thrilled to welcome PJ O'Rourke.
This podium is in violation of, there's really only one rule to public speaking, if you're a man, which is check your fly. So it really leaves one open to, you know. Anyway, I was going to read from my new book, but my new book is, in fact, it's an anthology. It's full of material from my previous books, and I have read them already. So I thought to myself, what writer can resist this 2016 presidential campaign? I'm full of righteous indignation about this campaign. You see, I am a political humorist, and I cannot be funnier than this campaign. I am a political satirist, and this campaign has been fully self-satirizing. And I am a political commentator, and I can't get a word in edgewise with Donald Trump around. So I'm full of righteous indignation, and I'm also unemployed. Who are these jacklegs, these highbinders, these wire pullers, mountebanks, swellheads, bunkum spigots, boodle artists, four flushers, animated spittoons, offering themselves as worthy for America's highest office? I mean, do they take us voters for fools? Well, yes, they do. Obviously, they do. But I mean, are they also deluded? Are they also insane? Are they receiving radio broadcasts on their teeth fillings saying that they would make a good president? Clinton, Carson, Sanders, Rubio, Bush, Fiorina, Cruz, Kasich, Huckabee, Christie, Santorum, O'Malley, Graham, Pataki, and Trump. That is not a list of presidential candidates. That is the worst law firm in the world. That is a law firm that couldn't get Caitlyn Jenner off on a charge of Bruce Jenner identity theft. I mean, has the office of the presidency, has it diminished in stature until it attracts only the leprechauns of public life? Or have our politicians, have they shrunk until none of them can pass the carnival test? You must be taller than the clown to run for president. I mean, you know, there is, at this point still, kind of an outside chance that the two candidates for president will be Clinton and Bush. I tremble for my country if that's the case. I mean, members of the electorate will go into the ballot booth. They will see those two names. They will think to themselves, as I often think to myself, gosh, I'm getting forgetful. I did this already. And they'll leave without marking the ballot. I mean, voter turnout will be 6%, you know. The shuttle from the old age home will send a few senile Republicans to the polls. A Democratic National Committee bus will collect some derelicts from Skid Row. And we will have the first president of the United States elected by a franchise limited to sufferers from Alzheimer's disease and drunken bums. So who have we got running for president? Well, there is Hillary Rodham Clinton. She retains her iron grip on second place in the race for the nomination because whoever is in first place is so far out ahead, we don't know who it is. You know? And I have some evidence to back up that statement. If you'll recall, pretty much at this stage in the 2008 election cycle, Barack Hussein Obama, he was about as likely to be nominated for president as some small-time community organizing junior senator from wherever, you know, with a name like somebody who had tried to sabotage an airplane with an underpants bomb, you know? I mean, and speaking of airplanes, Hillary carries more baggage than the Boeing that she used as Secretary of State, visiting every country that later blew up in her face in her quest to fulfill the mission of the United States Secretary of State, which is to accumulate frequent flyer mileage. On the upside, Hillary is familiar with the White House. She knows where the extra toilet paper is stored. She knows where the spare key to the nuke attack briefcase thing is hidden. It's on the Truman balcony, second pillar from the left. Now, failing Hillary, we had Joe Biden. Joe was the Democratic Party establishment's Plan B, but then the B part of Plan B, the Biden part, decided that this was a lousy plan. And my theory about why Joe Biden is not running for president is that Joe Googled himself. Because if you enter Joe Biden quotes into any search engine, this is what you will find. And I checked these quotes. I did my due diligence on this. Joe on Barack Obama, this was in 2008 during that campaign, Joe said, "You got the first mainstream African-American who is articulate and bright and clean and a nice-looking guy." Great, Joe. This is Joe on diversity. He said, "In Delaware, the largest growth of population is Indian Americans moving from India. You cannot go into a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts without a slight Indian accent." And I'm going, Joe, anybody else you'd like to offend? Well, how about the disabled? Vice President, he was speaking at a political fundraiser in Missouri, and he said, "I'm told Chuck Graham, state senator, is here. Stand up, Chuck. Let him see you. Missouri State Senator Chuck Graham is paraplegic." So I think we see why Joe is not running for president. There was some talk that he would might team up with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren as his VP candidate, and I'm not sure if Warren is not still in the picture. Maybe she'll be part of a Girls Gone Wild Democratic presidential ticket. Warren has Native American ancestry. How, as you may well ask. But it is a fundraising plus if she gets her own casino. Warren is an expert on bankruptcy law, giving her a vision for our nation's future. And Warren turned left, the only direction that the GPS units give in the hybrid cars that vegan aromatherapist Democratic primary voters drive. Then there's the candidate who, for a moment, seemed like the candidate who was so far of Hillary, in front of Hillary, that we didn't know who it was. Unfortunately, who it turned out to be is the screwy, kablooey commander of the Viet Cong, Bernie Sanders. Bernie's a socialist, actually says so himself. A socialist, he will take your flat-screen TV and give it to a family of pill addicts in the backwoods of Vermont. Bernie says he wants to make America more like Europe. Great idea, because Europe has had a swell track record for 100 years, you know. Ever since Archduke Ferdinand's car got a flat in Sarajevo in 1914, things have been just swinging in Europe, you know. Make America more like Europe. Where do you even go to get all the Nazis and the commies and the 90 million dead people that it would take to make America more like Europe, you know? Then there are the Republicans, Marco Rubio. Great kid. I love children. All the cute things they do, cute things they say, the way Marco blows through his GOP-issued campaign credit card allowance, the way my 11-year-old son Buster does. But Marco has got to stop it with the abortion stuff. Stop. Marco, stop with it. I feel like I want to take him aside, put my arm around his shoulders, and say, Marco, let me tell you how a real Republican approaches the abortion question. Don't make it legal. Don't make it illegal. Make it retroactive. Kid gets to be 25, he's still a bum whack. It's a position everyone can support. You know? Jeb Bush, he had everything. He had everything. He's young for a Republican. Phi Beta Kappa, successful businessman. Two-term governor of Florida, where balloting incompetence and corruption are vital to the GOP. Plus, Jeb, he was like rolling like a dirty dog in campaign contributions, you know. And then somehow it all went wrong, you know. Now, there's still hope there. I mean, I understand Jeb will legally change his name to George Herbert Walker Bush. Everybody likes him. And he only served one term, so he is constitutionally eligible to run again. Carly Fiorina. Maybe she can run America the way she ran Hewlett-Packard. You know, great. I mean, the way she ran Hewlett-Packard was fabulous if you shorted the stock. Hewlett-Packard's stock price fell more than 60% while Carly was CEO. I mean, I may forgive Carly, but my Keo plan will never forgive Carly, you know? Ben Carson, nothing to be said against him. I understand he spoke here, as a matter of fact. Nothing to be said against Ben Carson, unless you're one of those persnickety fact-checking types that all real journalists hate, you know? Dr. Carson is a soft-spoken gentleman. He rose from a background of social adversity and economic deprivation that makes, you know, President Obama look like the lost Bush brother. Carson went to Yale. He went to the University of Michigan Medical School. He completed his residency at Johns Hopkins, becoming the hospital's youngest ever director of pediatric neurosurgery at age 33 in 1984. Now, just to put a little perspective on that, 1984, Donald Trump was sending out invitations to his first bankruptcy. Jeb Bush was chairing meetings of the Dade County Republican Party in a phone booth. Carly Fiorina was in the break room at AT&T making coffee for the executives. And Marco Rubio was in eighth grade. Dr. Garson's a genius. He's the first surgeon to successfully separate Siamese twins co-joined at the head. And this is why I am asking Dr. Ben Carson to please quit running for president. Just quit running for president. Get back to work. Get back to work. Damn it, we need you. We need you. I mean, George W. and Jeb's heads might get co-joined. You know what I mean? True, they're not twins, but the Bush family is inbred, and freakish things can result from inbreeding. Or Dr. Carson could be removing Donald Trump's ruptured silicone brain implant that is endangering Republicans everywhere, you know? You know, I just want to say to Dr. Carson, your mom, your poor, hardworking mom wanted you to be a doctor, you know? Many of us have sons and daughters who will not get into medical school, you know, or do anything else of value to society, as far as I can tell so far. True, they're still teens, but, you know, it doesn't look good. These are the kids we send into politics, right? These are the kids where we tell them, you know, honey, you're special, and we love you very much, just the way you are, and it's okay that you're in your fourth year of ninth grade, and why don't you run for office, you know? And let's not forget about Rand Paul, although everybody else seems to have done so. Rand believes the federal government should obey the rule, mind your own business, and keep your hands to yourself. I call it the Bill and Hillary Clinton principle. Hillary, mind your own business. Bill, keep your hands to yourself. You know? Unfortunately, Rand's just not getting the Republican nomination, and this is because Rand Paul is a Republican, yes, but he is also a libertarian. And libertarianism, it appeals to those who consider themselves fiscal conservatives and social liberals. Now, fiscal conservative, social liberal, that means they want to get high and have sex while saving money. And who does not? But how are you going to get any Republicans to admit that in public? You know, so ease out, you know. Somebody pointed out to me that I've been forgetting Ted Cruz in this list. I have certainly been trying to, you know. I don't think we really need to go into Ted Cruz. But I will tell you this one thing about Ted Cruz is never, ever look at Ted Cruz and think Bill Murray as the sleazy lounge singer. You will never get that image out of your head. It looks exactly like Bill Murray as the sleazy lounge singer. Now, also among the 2000 presidential candidates, we have and have had what I call the Walking Dead. The Walking Dead. In fact, this came up at Halloween because the kids were, you know, thinking about going out for Halloween. And I'm going, hey, you know, are you looking for a swell zombie costume? Look no further than your nearest political poll. I mean, you know, talk about rotting corpses frightfully lurching around when they should be 6 feet under. I mean, you know, it was Bobby Jindal was still in the race at that point. We got Rick Santorum, John Kasich, Martin O'Malley, Lindsey Graham, Jim Webb, George Pataki, all polling below the plus or minus margin of undead error. You know, I mean, it's political zombies, you know, they're soulless. They're politicians. And they want to eat your brains because they obviously don't have any of their own or they would have been out of the race months before, you know. Costumes were easy to make. You just get one of Dad's dress shirts, rumple artfully, you know, roll up the sleeves, loosen the necktie to look like a regular guy, and then smear yourself with political gore. The Al Gore kind will do. And I was telling the kids, bonus, you know, as a political zombie, you can trick or treat at the houses in our neighborhood, and at town hall meetings, and VFW posts, and volunteer firemen spaghetti dinners, and evangelical churches. Downside, you might get spaghetti, a Bible, or two delegates to the Republican National Convention instead of candy. Why weren't these candidates buried at the ballot crossroads with a yard sign driven through their hearts? You know, I just don't know. And I was thinking about it a little bit. Bobby Jindal, I decided Bobby Jindal was kind of kept in the race by the Republican establishment in order to show how Republicans, unlike Joe Biden, how Republicans just love diversity. as long as you're prosperous and don't talk funny and you dress like a Republican the way Ben Carson does. Meanwhile, you know, the GOP establishment is also saying, you know, sort of sub rosa, they're saying, hey, Bobby, Ben, by the way, it's okay if you have some cousins managing flea bag motels or selling crack, you know, but you don't have to bring them to the country club, okay? Now, Rick Santorum, interesting case. Rick Santorum is the Republican voice of social conservatism. He's against abortion, he's against illegal immigrants, he's against gay marriage, he's in favor of church, and so are all Republicans until our kid knocks up the 15-year-old next door, or the yard chores need doing, or offending the LGBT community means letting Louis from Home Depot be our interior decorator, or until Christ conflicts with tea time, you know. So he's not happening. John Kasich, okay, John Kasich actually seriously mystifies me. He's not so much of a joke. He actually seriously mystifies me as a Republican and as a reporter. Kasich is very popular and very conservative governor of Ohio, a state that is as purple as Barney the dinosaur, you know? Barney's friends are big and small. They come from lots of places, and they all hate each other, you know? They all hate each other. They don't hate John. And, you know, Ohio is like a great microcosm of America. It's got all the conflicts that are going on in America now. It's got labor versus management. It's got stagnated wages versus the 1%. You know, it's got Tea Partiers versus immigrants. It's got blacks versus white. You name the conflict, Ohio has got the conflict. And Kasich has handled this. He beat an incumbent Democrat who was not an unpopular guy, beat him by a narrow margin, then went on to be reelected by a landslide. Before he was governor of Ohio, Kasich, he served 9 terms in Congress. And he served 9 terms in Congress, you know, to put it bluntly, shoveling important shit. You know, 18 years, he spent 18 years on the House Armed Services Committee. He spent 6 years as chairman of the House Budget Committee. He knows about stuff. You know, and I look at him and I go, well, no wonder he's polling at 4% because the GOP is in no damn mood for competent, experienced politicians with a broad popular appeal. No, you know. John Kasich is, as far as I can tell, John Kasich is a 2-word Republican suicide note, you know? Martin O'Malley is another one that's like utterly mystifies me. O'Malley's the ex-governor on nowhere, because if you take the Washington suburbs away, Maryland's like Appalachia in the west. It's impoverished Delmarva Peninsula fishing villages in the east, plus Baltimore. You know, Afghanistan on the Patapsco, you know. Baltimore is grossly impoverished. It has a homicide rate that is 26% higher than Detroit's. And ABC News has called Baltimore the heroin capital of the United States. And O'Malley was its mayor. The only thing I can figure is that O'Malley lost a game of truth or dare. You know, and that he is running for president rather than answer the question of how bad do the Ravens suck this year. You know? And South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, too hawkish to appeal to the general electorate, not crazy enough to appeal to Republican primary voters. Maybe he thinks he can gain support from progressives, you know, a group that is, to judge by Bernie Sanders rallies, currently larger and sillier than usual. Lindsey's strategy is to have a girl's name. He's tricking progressives into thinking they're voting for America's first transgender president. And on it goes. So my response to this, I'm supporting Donald Trump. And I'm supporting Trump because of something that the great political satirist H.L. Mencken said. Mencken said, democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it good and hard. You know, America's... he becomes president. Trump's his chief domestic policy goal. Excuse me, I got a little... remnants of a cold air. Trump's chief domestic policy is going to be to be on TV. You know, I mean, and that's one reason he's so strong in the polls. Americans can identify with Trump because the chief goal of everyone in America is to be on TV. You know? And as when he's president, Trump will get to be on TV all the time, 24/7, much as he wants. You know, but this might not be all bad because just spraying his hair during commercial breaks, this is going to keep Trump so busy that he will be unable to push other bird brain domestic policy goals the way certain other presidents have done. And Trump can yell "you're fired" all he likes. It's going to make for a healthy turnover in Trump cabinet appointees such as Ivanka and Dennis Rodman and Larry King and Vince McMahon. Plus, Trump understands the American economy. He will grow America's economy the way he grew his own economy with bad debt, bad debt, bad debt, and more bad debt. You know, America's average household debt in America, it's now more than $225,000. Now, Trump has restructured $3.5 billion of his business debt and $900 million of his personal debt. Restructured being the Trump way of saying that he didn't pay it, you know. And we Americans know a leader when we see one, you know. Then imagine Trump's foreign policy. Here's a guy who's under the illusion, you know, you've probably read about this in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Forbes. He's under the illusion he's about 10 times richer than he actually is. And not only that, but he believes Obama was born in Karjakistan to the Queen of Sheba, you know. And he thinks childhood vaccination caused the movie Rain Man, you know. I mean, so Russia and China and Iran and ISIS and the Taliban and Hamas, they're going to be paralyzed with fear because who knows what this lunatic is going to do, you know? Well, what he'll do is he'll build hundreds of Trump casinos, Trump hotels, and Trump resorts in Moscow, Beijing, Tehran, Raqqa, Kandahar, and the Gaza Strip, and then they will all go bankrupt the way the Trump Taj Mahal, Trump Plaza Hotel, and Trump Entertainment Resorts did, you know? And this is Trump is going to leave Russia trying to palm off eastern Ukraine on angry bondholders and China auctioning distressed property in the Spratly Islands. And hell, this might work. No, it won't. But anyway, that's all I know. If people have some questions, Melissa, if you have some questions, I will make up some other stuff. Okay.
Thank you. So you're endorsing Trump? Is that what I heard?
Okay. I am. I don't know what I'm gonna do about that. I mean, this is like ceasing to be a joke. And don't you feel a little guilt as part of the news media that we like gave this guy attention because he was so funny and stupid acting?
The other day, Seth Meyers said that the Trump candidacy has been like being on a tilt-a-whirl, right? At first, you're like, yay, wee, and then after a while, you kind of get sick of your
stomach. I'm starting to get sick.
It stops being funny after a bit.
That was very good.
That makes perfect
sense. I'm going to steal that analogy.
I guess my first question, so I was so excited to hear you had a new book out, but my first question has to be, is everything okay? Because
is everything okay?
Between us, you know, we're all family here. This is a book, a compendium of essays that you've written over the last, you know, 30 some odd years.
40 more.
Tell me this is not a like pre-retirement thing. You're going to keep writing.
No, I've got kids who are, my daughter turns 18 on Friday, tomorrow. And she's got college narrowed down to, she's applying to 400 colleges. 200 that she can't get into, 200 I can't afford, you know. And I got two more coming behind her, so no, this is not.
Okay, good.
This is not a farewell. No.
Good to know. And how did you go about picking the stories that you were going to include here? Well, and did you read anything from back in like the 80s and go, I can't believe I wrote that?
Oh, yeah. You find those things in there, especially when I was at the National Lampoon, you know, as a kid at the National Lampoon. I wrote some stuff that, wow, you know, I would so go to jail for today. Just, you know. It's like trigger. There isn't a trigger big enough for the trigger warning that some of that stuff would. And microaggression hardly does it justice. In fact, we were into macroaggressions. But I've always had the same editor. I have a very unusual publishing history. I mean, I think this is the kind of thing that went on in the 19th century and the early 20th century, but it's very rare today. Morgan Entrekin at Grove Atlantic, runs Grove Atlantic, and owns a big chunk of it. Morgan and I started out together when we were kids. He was a junior editor at Dell. He signed me up for my first book. He moved up over to Simon & Schuster, signed me up for my second book. Then he got an imprint at what was then the Atlantic Monthly Press and signed me up for my next book. Eventually, Morgan took over Atlantic, merged it with Grove. We've done every book together. So we sat down with all the books that we've done together, and we went through, and he picked out his favorites, and I picked out my, and we'd all worked on these things together, so the favorites were pretty close, and so we got this big pile of favorites together, and we gave them to the managing editor at Grove Atlantic, and she goes, "Oh, great, you have a 7,500-page book." So then Morgan and I spent the next couple months with little hatchets killing our darlings. "And we love you, love you, or love you, wonderful little beast, die, die." So, and it still turned out to be a doorstop, a boat anchor. I personally am waiting for the Reader's Digest large type edition to come out. Oh, Lord.
I also wanted to talk about, just quickly, because of the recent current events in San Bernardino, you've talked before about gun control. Reading your stuff, you seem to be somewhat for it, but you know, maybe you're thinking it's not necessarily realistic. I'd love your thoughts on where the parties are on, how we deal with gun control, or if that's the issue at any rate. Like, how do you deal with what's happened in San Bernardino?
I feel sorry for politicians about this. I really do. And politicians on the right and on the left both. Because there isn't really any, there's no truth to be told. You cannot come and tell the voting public the truth of the matter. You can say, we need stronger gun control, and that's a nice sentiment, and I understand where it comes from, and it would certainly seem to be true. You can say, we need better mental health treatment in this country, and that doubtless is true, too. But the truth of the matter is, this is a genie that cannot be stuffed back in the bottle. I don't know how many guns there are in America, and neither does anybody else. There certainly is a gun for every adult in America, every adult male. There's probably a gun for every adult. There are probably 319 million of the things out there. I'll tell you a little story about gun control that I was just thinking about today because of the horrible events yesterday. I was in Georgia, not the state, but the country, just as it broke away, this would be about 1990, just as it broke away from the crumbling old USSR. So I'm in Georgia, and the reason I'm in Georgia is they're having a civil war, as was kind of customary with the post-Soviet republics, and they're all shooting each other. And there are guns all over the place, and not just military guns. It wasn't just like they'd raided the army stash of guns. There are guns from World War I. There are guns from World War II. There are guns like from way back, you know. I mean, there are pistols. There are machine guns. They're the kind of machine guns that the British and Americans did airdrops all over Europe to the resistance fighters during World War II. And so on and so forth. And I go, wait a minute. I said, I was under the impression that the USSR had the strictest gun controls on the face of the earth. And they said, oh, yeah. Yeah, it did. And I said, well, where did all these guns come from? Mm-hmm. And they said, well, back in 1920, when the Civil War, Russian Civil War, was going on, and it became clear that the Reds were going to win, we buried them. We took the guns. We smeared them with lamb fat, we wrapped them in hides, and we buried them in the garden, in the fields. And I said, that's 70 years ago. Everybody who buried those guns is dead. You know, the children of the people who buried those guns are dead. We remembered where the guns were. And back they came, you know. And I was actually telling this story to a group of students at Berkeley last night. And I said, PhD alert, lamb fat obviously has preservative qualities, anti-corrosive capacity, little suspected. But it's darn hard to get rid of guns. They're a relatively simple piece of machinery. They're relatively easily repaired. All too easily operated, and how we would go about ridding our nation of this vast supply of these things is a question that's quite beyond how one stands on Second Amendment rights or how one stands on gun control. It's just a, and what politician can come out, you know, one of the things, is, well, off the subject, but one of the things I've always felt about politicians, and feel, you have to feel, I mean, it's hard to pity politicians. I mean, they do put themselves in this position, after all. But they really are, if you think about it, politicians cannot tell you the truth. They really can't tell you the truth. It's sort of like the way you can't tell the whole truth about your spouse or your children. Politicians can't tell us the whole truth about us. I mean, imagine the politician that stood up on the campaign stump and said, no, I can't fix public education. Because the problem is not funding, the problem's not overcrowding, the problem's not teachers' unions, the problem's not lack of computer equipment in the classroom, the problem is your damn kids. That person is not getting elected.
You know, in a related, potentially, we're not really sure of all the facts of what happened in San Bernardino, but even prior to that, with the shootings in Paris and the resulting immigration debate, both from in terms of Syrian and Iraqi refugees, plus prior to that, we've had an ongoing immigration debate, especially among Republican candidates. Now, your stance on immigration has been a little different than some of your fellow Republicans.
I am a total. I'm a pro-immigration person. Why are we not Japan? Why isn't our economy frozen the way Japan's is? Why isn't our economy frozen the way China's will be with the demographic trends? And it's immigration. I mean, we're not having enough kids to, well, me and my wife are doing our best, but I mean, most of us are not having enough kids to make the replacement rate. We're an aging society. I notice that in the mirror every morning. And what keeps us vigorous as a nation is immigration. Plus, we're a nation of immigrants. I mean, if somebody wants to argue with me about immigration, say we shouldn't have any immigration in this country, they had better be a full-blooded Native American, not Elizabeth Warren. I want somebody for real, you know. They got a few things to say about the problems with immigration, and they deserve to be listened to. But the rest of us, come on, where'd we come from? You know, we all came from some other place, you know. And every time we came, whatever group we belong to, whether we're Irish or whether we're Jewish or whether we're Italian or whether or whatever, every time we came over, everybody who was here already said, oh, it's the end of it. You know, that's the, oh, that place is going to hell now. You know? Oh, they let them in. You know? Whoa, you know. And it didn't happen. You know, it didn't happen, and it's not going to happen now. But, you know, the problem is fundamentally, I mean, besides the attitudes, which are horrible as far as I'm concerned, But there is a problem. The Democratic candidates have cast themselves in a generally pro-immigration light. Our immigration and naturalization program is so screwed up. It is the worst bureaucracy. I don't know. I'm sure there are other people in this audience besides myself who've tried to help people get through, people whose visas situation was in doubt in gray areas, or they're having trouble renewing it. Anybody who has ever come up against the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So I'm in New Hampshire. This happened to me in New Hampshire. It happened to me with a young woman who was working, was our nanny. And she'd come into the United States legally, but then her visa status got messed up. I went to my congressman, lived down the road, who's a buddy of mine. I went to my senator, who at that time was young John Sununu, one of the smartest guys ever, a great guy. John Sununu has got a person in his office, or had, and presumably the current senator does too, has a person in his office devoted to nothing but trying to sort out people's visa problems. This is New Hampshire. We've only got about 8 immigrants, you know, and like 6 of them are French Canadians. You know, what is this about? And John told me, and my congressman was then, Charlie Bass, told me the same thing. They said, it is just like running 30 miles an hour into a wall of mud trying to deal with immigration and naturalization. That agency needs to be ripped apart and put back together again.
Well, in addition, sort of on the related subject of immigration. And you guys are going to get this book. I assume you're all going to get this book. And you look at it, and it's a big book. One place I highly recommend that you start is with Dispatches from the Gulf War, which is a lengthy essay about basically Mr. O'Rourke's adventures in the Arabian Peninsula. You basically describe the problem as this. When the Turks backed the wrong horse in World War I, the French and English divvied up the region in a manner both completely self-serving and unbelievably haphazard, like monkeys at a salad bar. and we sort of continue to deal with the effects today. What is your take on what's happening in Syria and Iraq? And what we
should do? A good friend of mine who knows more about this subject than almost anybody, a guy named Charlie Glass, he was ABC's Beirut, Middle East bureau chief for many years, and now he's a journalist and writes books, and he wrote a book some years back about the Middle East, which he called Tribes with Flags. He's saying these are not nations, these are tribes with flags, and he laid out a lot of the problems, which, he was pessimistic, and he wasn't even pessimistic enough. And I was he emailed me not all that long ago, about 6 months ago, emailed me from Damascus, sitting at a bar. He said, I'm sitting in a bar in Damascus thinking I could use some help with this bottle of Irish whiskey. And because I spent 20 years as a foreign correspondent, mostly covering, I filed from like 40 countries, none of them the nice ones. Anyway, Charlie said, do people over there really understand there are no good guys in this? There just are no good guys. And I said, no, they don't understand it, but they probably will come to, you know, too late. You know, they're, you know, and Charlie's position, Charlie's a little bit more of an absolutist about this than I am, but Charlie's position is basically there's no group. While you can feel compassion for individuals, and while there are honorable and decent individuals, of course, engaged in this stuff, there is no group whose motives are pure and who you can support without, you know, caveat or cavil. And I fear, you know, I would say, but Charlie has spent a lot more time with the Kurds than I have. I'm very sympathetic to the Kurdish forces. He said, yeah, that's true. Some of them are great. And he said, and some of them are brutal terrorists, you know, that have been blowing people up in Turkey for time out of mind, you know. So I said, even there, you know, you're not on safe ground.
We're going to take a quick moment here for our podcast. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to PJ O'Rourke about politics and his new book, Thrown Under the Omnibus. I'm Melissa Kane, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. I want to switch real quick to your process in terms of, you know, sort of how you write. As you all heard in his initial remarks, Mr. O'Rourke is, of course, a master of insults to some degree. I was reading through your book, Bucketheads, Peacemongers, Bumwads, Egghead Flap Gums. Do you keep a little notebook where you write these? And if so, will you put that on eBay?
Yeah, I do keep notes about that. I do keep notes about vocabulary. I have a wonderful collection of slang dictionaries, many of them dating back to the 1920s and 30s, and I go through those things regularly for, you know, insults that need to be like animated spittoon is when I got out of there, and I thought, God,
special.
That is like so old school. You know, that needs to be revived. You know, so that's fun. But I think what my process as a writer has to do with, like, I mean, I'm a reporter, I'm a journalist, and most of the things I've covered have been pretty serious. And I'm not a stand-up comedian. I like to tell jokes. I like to make people laugh, but I'm not a stand-up comedian. And then because everything I say, there is a serious point in there. At no point do I stand back from something I say and say, just kidding, you know, this is not true. I'm not just kidding. But I think really what that has to do with, has much more to do with background than has anything to do with me. I come from a great big Irish family. I've got about 20 first cousins. And those of you who are Irish who know about this, there are two kinds of Irish families. There's the hitting kind, and there's the teasing kind. Mm-hmm. If you're lucky, you come from the teasing kind. I come from the teasing kind of Irish family. That is the way that they communicated everything. They communicated love, they communicated anger, they communicated approval, disapproval, irritation. Any emotion you can imagine, they would they conveyed by teasing and by joking. And I mean, it would be something truly terrible to snap them out of this. It would have to be something like the funeral of a child or something, you know. Because even the regular O'Rourke funerals, and when you have enough family as big as mine, they're on pretty much on a weekly basis, you know. It'd still be. I mean, I remember when my grandfather died at 83, which was back in 1960. He was considered ripe old age, especially considering the mileage on Granddad. And he died right before President Kennedy was elected, and the funeral was right after President Kennedy was elected. And my grandfather was one of those Irish, and they were not rare, who hated the Kennedys, just detested the Kennedys.
Why?
Lace curtain Irish, fruit on the table when nobody's sick in the house. nothing to do with the Kennedys. Yeah. So, like, the first thing, I'm 13 or something, you know, and I'm crying. I loved my granddad, and I'm standing by coughing, crying. And his sister, my great-aunt Helen, comes up and says, "It's a good thing your granddad died when he did." And, "What do you mean, Aunt Helen?" He says, "Because it would have killed him to see Jack Kennedy in the White House anyway." So that, you know, that was the atmosphere I came out of.
Where do you go for inspiration? Like, if you're looking for something to write about, is it you just go to, like, motherjones.com and just get... inspired?
I don't even have to go that far. You know, you just hit any random key on the computer, check any random channel on the news has been, all my lifetime, the news has been a target-rich environment. You know?
That's fair.
I don't think we've been, certainly since I turned 21 back in, you know, when mastodons roamed the earth, I don't think we've been without a silly moment. You know, so.
That's true. That's true. You talk a lot about the fact that you are Republican and then communist and then Republican again. And, you know, as a writer, as a humorous writer, first of all, are you friends with Dennis Miller? I feel like y'all should get together.
Yes, I am.
And like chat.
I am friends with Dennis Miller.
Laugh about back when you were like liberal. There's also a question.
I'm like also the only guy who loved his NFL commentary. Because that play reminds me of another play by a Greek playwright, Aristophanes. All the rest of football fans are going, WTF. And I'm going, you go, Dennis. I saw a little bit of Lysistrata in that myself.
One of our members of the audience wants to know, are there other satirists and political writers that you admire, such as Mencken, for example, who you quoted earlier?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to talk about the live ones, you know, Carl Hiaasen, I mean, he's known mostly as, writing these comic Florida novels. Carl is strongly political, as a matter of fact. Carl was, for many years, the chief political chief political columnist at the Miami Herald, and covered all the lunatic local Florida politics down there. He's great. Christopher Buckley is fantastic. You know, he's not the politically focused the way his father Bill was, but there's strong political content. And I mean, he's written a lot of comedies about, a lot of comic novels about Washington, and they're absolutely fabulous. Dave Barry, I love. You know, I mean, Dave Barry's never overtly political, but he's got a great eye for the stupid, and that covers a lot of politics. So yeah, there are a lot of people out there that I'm sure I'm not naming all of them off the top of my head, but.
You know. And you've described yourself now as a conservative libertarian.
Yeah, I lean more in the. I am.
Is there a liberal libertarian?
Is there? Oh yes, there are left. There are left libertarians and right libertarians. Definitely, and libertarians share a fundamental idea that the unit that we know about, you know, the unit that we as humans know about is the individual. The one thing that we cannot deny is that human beings, that the humanity is made up of individuals, and that everything that every organization, not just government, but all human organizations need to always take the individual into first account. Is what this organization doing good for the individual? Is it respectful of the individual? Does it give benefits and liberty and responsibility? That's the one that nobody likes. But does it endow the individual with greater respect, with greater liberty, with greater responsibility? And that really is not that. That's an attitude. That's not an ideology. So there are people pretty much across the spectrum. And the problem, of course, with libertarians is they cannot form a political party because basically if you get two libertarians in a room, you get three opinions on a subject. And so, it's a little hopeless. The Republican part of me is partly just the way I grew up. I'm ethnically Republican. Not so much on the Irish side, but my mother her family was from downstate Illinois. So my grandmother was a big force in my life, my mother's mother. Was born on a farm near Springfield, Illinois, in an area where basically the only Democrat they'd ever heard of was John Wilkes Booth. And she was like really serious Republican, of the sort of thing. Like, she was mad at Roosevelt. I don't mean FDR Roosevelt. She was still mad at Teddy because he split the Republican Party and allowed a Southerner, Woodrow Wilson, to be elected president. So she was still mad about that. So I grew up with grandma's, very firm about this. And I go off to college and turn into the usual college left winger. I come home from college with my hair down to wherever and a big red fist on the back of my jean jacket. And my grandmother looks at me and she said, "Pat, I'm worried about you. Are you becoming a Democrat?" Grandma, LBJ is a Democrat, and he's killing all these innocent Viet Cong and causing all these riots in inner cities and exploiting everybody capitalistically. Of course I'm not a Democrat. I'm a communist. And she looked at me and she said, "Just as long as you're not a Democrat." Really mattered to her.
But you've you certainly traveled to a number of places with different systems. You write about your travel to the USSR, to Berlin, and other places like Hong Kong, which are, of course, sort of capitalist over on the other side. How did that inform your ideology, or was your ideology pretty set before you got there?
Ideology was fairly well set in terms of sort of libertarian conservatism. What was not well set and what was informed by my travels was not so much my political ideology as my sense of economics. Mm-hmm. Now, for instance, Sweden, an extensive visit to Sweden in the 90s made me think twice about socialism. Swedes have a very socialistic system and it works very well for Swedes. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that I disapproved of their system or disapproved of them or anything. But actually, Milton Friedman made this remark many years before. Some Swedish economist was in the United States and, very left-wing, and he's going, "In Sweden, we have no poverty." And Milton Friedman said, "That's interesting because among Swedes in America, we have no poverty either." Is it cultural or what? Thing is, what I realized about Sweden, the system works, but it's 8 million people and they're all alike. All completely alike. They all want the same things, So sure, it works. They all want a free PhD, But if you start now, Sweden itself found out, it was beginning to find out in the 90s and has since found out, as the portion of immigrant people in Sweden has grown, they've discovered that there are all sorts of people who don't want the same things as the Swedes do. And it's caused a lot of tension over there. For instance, I went out to they have a way of putting their poor people way out on the outside of the city. You got to take like an hour train ride out to these suburbs. They're nicer versions of those nasty suburbs around Paris. And so I go out and visit with people out there. And what they wanted to do is start small businesses. Well, starting small business is not something that it was easy to do in Sweden in the 1990s. They wanted to, to trade and to engage in merchant activity. And the Swedes are going, "You want to sell things? But why?"
you can get a PhD for free.
We have a guest question. A guest wants to know your thoughts on Chris Christie. And also, what is your dream presidential race matchup? And this could be as an American citizen or as a political satirist.
Yeah, well, Chris Christie, you know, I sort of fell in love with Chris Christie as a candidate when he responded. He was doing like a town hall meeting, and there was an inquiring citizen who asked a question about one of Christie's policies, and Christie responded, "Sit down and shut up." Boy, did that take me back home. Everybody's going, "Oh my God, Chris Christie, that's the end of his campaign." You know, like, yeah, that's not going to play, you know, west of New Jersey. And not play west of New Jersey, that's everybody's family life. You know, I mean, how did every discussion in, you know, all of our families begin and end when we were kids? Just sit down and shut up. You know? So I thought, yeah, he's got leadership potential. You know, I think Chris Christie actually is, in certain ways, a good candidate, and he's got that prosecutorial side that, like, scares me a little bit, but, you know, I think it would also scare some people, might not be so bad to scare. My dream lineup, now you don't want to go there, because, and I'll tell you a story about why. I won't tell you what my dream lineup is, but, so one day I was off duty, I was hanging around someplace, nobody knew I was a reporter, I was in this little store in a little town, New Hampshire, doing some Christmas shopping or something, and all of a sudden, a TV crew, local television crew, comes rushing back through the door into this, like, basket shop, handmade baskets. And I'm going, what could possibly be on the evening news about handmade baskets? And also, they weren't facing the right way. They're facing the door, you know. And I said, what's up with you guys? And they said, oh, my God, there's a great big liquid petroleum gas tank across the street, and it sprung a leak. And I said, well, I guess this wouldn't be the moment to step outside and have a smoke. And the TV cameraman looks at me and he said, oh, please do. He said, we're reporters. We worship different gods than you do. So, yeah, that's my dream. No, I don't know.
Well, how do politicians react to you? I assume you go to D.C. fairly often or to once in a while, or even at your home in New Hampshire. I can imagine some candidates stumping, you know, how they have to go door to door and pretend to care what everybody in New Hampshire
they
thinks.
They do, yeah.
Like, they come to your door, they, you know, they're ringing the bell, and there's you, and they go, oh, boy.
No, it doesn't really work that way. They are, you know, if you were to look up, and what's that, not the physician's desk reference, but the psychiatrist's desk reference, whatever is up.
The DSM.
Yeah, right, exactly. If you look up narcissistic personality disorder, it's politicians. And if you look up and you read the section on narcissistic personality disorder, there are like 11 things. And if, like, you hit 6 of these, you can be diagnosed as having narcissistic. Well, it's 11 out of 11 for every politician. It's complete narcissistic. And as long as you mention them, they don't care. You know? Yeah, I mean, the only way you can offend them is by not mentioning them. It doesn't matter what you say, because they're not listening. All they're hearing is their names, like dogs, you know? You know, you give instructions to your dog, you go, oh, Fluffy, can I stay out of the garbage? You know, get down from that chair, you know? All it hears is Fluffy.
Oh, my goodness. Excuse me one second. Audience member wants to know, Redskin or Red Hawk?
Redskin or Red Hawk. This is because I, like Paul Ryan, went to Miami of Ohio. And there was a 25-year debate about the name of the sports teams, which were Redskins when I was there, and I graduated like 1969. This debate was already going on in the late 60s, and it took 25 years to resolve it, which resulted in them now being called the Red Hawks. I looked it up. There is no such thing. But whatever. And so all old members, I haven't checked Paul Ryan on this, but all old Miami alumni, I always kid ourselves about this, because in the midst of this furious debate on campus, somebody went out and asked the Miami Tribe, which is what the university was named after, and members of the Miami Tribe have free tuition at Miami. And anyway, they went out. The Miami Tribe now lives in Oklahoma, and somebody went out and asked the Miami Tribe how they felt about this debate. And I think they put it in rather stronger terms than this, but the message was that they didn't care.
Oh.
The message was they really didn't care. but nonetheless, the debate went on. So Red Hawks versus Redskins. When I run into a fellow Miami alum, it's Redskins. Otherwise, I adhere to the politically correct.
As you do, yeah. Because you are all about
sensitive. I'm all about being a sensitive guy.
Wait, there have been a number of humorists recently, Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, sort of publicly saying that they refuse to do stand-up on college campuses anymore because it's just way too PC. They can't really say the things they want to say. In going through some of your earlier stuff from the 80s, for example.
Not so much. So,
there were a couple things that I read. I was like, yeah, whoa. I'm not sure that would fly today.
There were a couple things I didn't include.
do you feel the same way? Do you think we've gone too far, or are you less comfortable having these conversations?
I just feel like people my age from the 60s, you know, I mean, kids have to rebel. They just have to rebel. They have to rebel. They have to upset their elders. They have to do stuff that, like, drives us nuts. And they have to be weird. You know, I mean, it's like in the kid constitution or something, or the kid working, you know, the work the rules, you know, union laws of being a kid. You got to be weird and you got to upset your parents. Well, people my age, we used up all the weird. You know, we just used up all the weird things. We set them, weird hair, we grew it, weird beards, we had them. You know, I mean, you name it. We used up the weird. So when it came kids now, their turn to be weird, like they got to get all these piercings and tattoos. Ouch, that must hurt. You know, and they've got to come up with, like, they have to, like, pull these causes out of their ear, you know, because like we used up all the big causes, you know, and they haven't really got a shooting war with people being drafted and stuff to, you know, so they're going like, okay, well, what can we protest about? I don't know, you know, it's trigger warnings. So I just sort of feel sorry for them. And then when it comes to taboos, you know, I mean, there's like, I mean, this is not a young room. You all grew up around the table, I'm sure, where, you know, depending on what your ethnic background was, where you heard some words that you just could not use in public around the dinner table in front of the kids. You know, I mean, to give, you know, one example is, and you know, on the Irish side of my family, when you were trying to get somebody's price, and they were car salesmen, so they talked about this kind of stuff. You Jewed somebody down. It was a verb, you know. It wasn't, they never didn't connect it with Jewish people. It was just what you did, you know. Like Jip, you know, I mean, that it too is an ethnic slur. It's so deeply embedded in our language, you don't even think about it. But that's the kind of language you would hear, and that was, like, by no means the worst of the kind of thing that you heard around the dinner table. On the other hand, did I ever hear the word shit or fuck or piss or even hell, unless, you know, it was like some great aunt going, you are going to hell if you don't stop doing that, unless they really meant it.
You're a Democrat.
Never heard a goddamn, never heard any language like that, and yet I heard language that no one in this room would ever use. And so you think about, is there maybe in society, is there an X? Is there a taboo constant? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just the taboo just, you know, what the taboo is just shifts, you know. But the number of taboos remain constant, you know. And I was talking to these kids from Berkeley. They've got a nice little thing called the Berkeley Forum over there. And I was talking to them and I said, you know, PhD alert for social science students. You know, the taboo constant, you know, you could do some research on this. I'm sure
you get it for free in Sweden.
Yeah.
So you also wrote about California.
Yeah, I make a lot of fun of California.
Yeah, do talk a lot about California.
I got a sister and a sister-in-law out here, so fair game.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
You
know what we say in the rest of the country is that every now and then America gets tilted and everything that's loose rolls out here.
What did you write? This is one of my favorites. In Republicans Evolving, an essay from 2011, the marine iguana, for example, washing ashore from the mainland, it learned to go with the flow. It became the only seagoing lizard. It eats nothing but algae. Here's a lizard version of moving to Humboldt County, California.
Well, if it's smoked algae, that'd probably be more true, yeah.
But you also wrote, in California, on time doesn't mean anything at all. An appointment for a meeting at 3 o'clock on Tuesday indicates that there won't be a meeting and there might not be a Tuesday. Few words and no numbers have any meaning west of the Nevada border. How are we doing?
I would say also south of about, 50 miles south of here. I lived for a while in Los Angeles and really didn't like it. And there was my animus has to do with the southern part of your state. Right? not here into the north. I love the north, actually. I think the north is absolutely, San Francisco is great. Silicon Valley, I don't know what they're doing out there, and I'm not sure they know what they're doing out there, but I do know it's being valued too highly, whatever they're doing out there. For Facebook worth $45 billion. Facebook is worth $45 billion. And I got two teenage daughters. I look at my, I say Facebook to my two teenage daughters. You would think I had asked them to go, harness up the buggy in the yard. Face what? Dad, that is so old, Honestly, you'd think I'd ask them to go chisel something in stone.
they're way ahead of you.
Yeah.
You, and as a San Franciscan, of course, I especially took note of your comments about progressives. When you spoke about, when you were on the Ship of Fools, this is an essay about a trip in 1987, the USSR. He was talking with a tour guide. He was talking about his fellow shipmates.
I should explain this for a moment.
Yeah,
Michael Kinsley, mm-hmm. who some of you may well be familiar with, was at one time the editor of Harper's back in the 80s. And I was, this before I was a foreign correspondent, and I was just kind of like a loose humor writer, loose rolled out here, worked a little out here. And Michael decides what he wants to do is send me on a tour of the Soviet Union. This is like the butt end of the Brezhnev years, and send me on a tour of the Soviet Union with a bunch of pro-Soviet, pro-peace. It's a tour sponsored by The Nation magazine, and Michael thought it would be really funny to send me with The Nation magazine.
And it was.
But they were all over 100. They were all still arguing about Trotsky and Stalin and all this stuff. They had not moved off, 1930s top dead center.
And you wrote, you were talking to one of the tour guides, and you said, yes, these people are really progressive. They're highly progressive. They are such great progressives. I think I have almost all of them talked into defecting. And he responds, no. Don't send them here. Well, I hope San Francisco has been, and the Bay Area has accommodating
like
to
this.
You despite
so
our...
So we're going through the Don Volga Canal, and which is... a big canal, and we're on a pretty good sized tour boat, and there's this woman, had to be in her 80s, anyway, she's a little bitty woman, and just full of communist fervor to this day. She wouldn't have called herself a communist, of course, she was a progressive, anyway, she is standing by the railing, she and I are standing by the railing, and we're looking at this giant wall of concrete that's, as the lock gradually fills up in the Don Volga Canal. And she's looking at this wall of concrete, and she's going, oh, the Soviets, such marvelous engineers, the Soviets. And I'm going, that is one big wall of concrete. There's no doubt about it. And then she looks over the railing of the boat, and she goes, and where do they get all the water? Perfect.
Amazing. So many wonderful adventures. I'm sure you'll all get the book. It is terrific. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
We want to welcome our celebrated political satirist, PJ O'Rourke. We also want to thank our audience here and on the radio and on television and the internet. I'm Melissa Kane, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.